Welcome again. Now we can continue the gradual training. And we've been doing a few kinds of detours on the way, which is always nice because it is requiring that you bring in suttas from left and from right to kind of flesh out the details a little bit. But now I want to get back to the main framework again of the gradual training. And so this is the first sutta in your printout, which is the shorter sutta of the simile of the elephant's footprint. So, as I mentioned before, the gradual training, it matches up with the Noble Eightfold Path. And for now, we have sort of been going through the first six factors, which includes right effort, right, of the six. And this next part here, which is called clear comprehension, is what is called here, or full awareness, actually, is called here. This is also, in a sense, part of right effort. Sometimes it's said to be part of the seventh factor of Satipatthana, but really, I think it really belongs with right effort. So it's a continuation of right effort. It's a little bit monastic, this part of it, but it also applies to lay life as well. It's just a matter of applying it in the right way. So I'll just read through this, and then we will comment on it as usual. So, as we saw before, he possesses the happiness that is unsullied, and then he continues the training here. So he becomes one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning here. Who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs. Who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl. Who acts in fullness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting here. Who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating here. Who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. So this is this passage on full awareness. The Pali word is, I'm sure, is a word many of you will have heard, is sampajanya, which is sometimes translated as clear comprehension. And sampajanya is derived from the same word as panya. Panya is wisdom, right? So this is related to wisdom practice. And again, you can see how wisdom is always such an important part of this factor of right effort. Wisdom always comes back to wisdom. This is the main kind of underlying support for being able to do the right effort all the way through. So you have full awareness in regard to all of these things. And you may wonder, what is it? This is kind of a strange list of things, right? You may wonder, what is it about these things? And what is probably going on here, what this is about? This is about all those things that you're supposed to do as a monastic when you're not meditating, right? So when you're not meditating, you do these things. Going forward and returning usually refers to going into the village for alms food, right? You go forward into the village and then you come back again there, right? That's forward and returning here. And all of these are similar kinds of things. Looking ahead and looking away is like you're looking up to see if somebody's going to offer you food, because you would go through the houses. Some places people would offer you food, sometimes they wouldn't. So you have to kind of keep a lookout on what is going on there. Extending your limbs is a similar kind of thing. It's like, you know, putting out your bowl and these kind of things. If you know the kind of what usually happens on arms round, you can get some idea what all of these factors actually are about. So this is really about those things that you do when you're not meditating. Yeah. And of course, this is also the idea here. the reason why you do all of these things with full awareness is to stop yourself from being led astray, right? Led astray by nice sights, nice things happening, especially when you go into the village, you know, you might see things that are not suitable. Like when you come to Bangkok, for example, as a monk, all kind of things, you know, that you're not used to when you live in the forest in Serpentina. So so you kind of are careful what you do and where you look and what you, all of these kind of things. So this is the idea here. And as so often, if you don't do this kind of things, if you don't have clear awareness or full awareness of what you're doing, if you look at kind of, if you, instead of looking for the alms food, you look at the pretty girls or whatever, right? Then you may have a problem, and your monastic life may be quite short. This is how things go, right? And you get dragged down into things. This is also true in lay life. It's all about, remember, about holding the defilements in check. And there are certain things that we do in life. If we do too much of those things, they will drag you out from what is suitable, and you will kind of end up breaking a precept, end up becoming angry perhaps, and doing all kinds of things because you don't have clear awareness about those things that are supportive for your practice. There are certain types of entertainments, right, which may be very violent or very have other aspects to it that may actually be very detrimental. Certain parts of the city that are not really good to go to. There's so many things in lay life as well whereby you can decide whether something is appropriate, whether something is going to help you in your practice or be detrimental. So it depends how serious you are about the Buddhist path, right? If you're very serious about it, these kind of things too become important, that you do things in the right way. Now the Buddha, when he talks about full awareness, it's not really explained in great detail in the actual suttas. I'll come back to another sutta in a second. But in the commentary, there's a nice system that defines what is going on here with full awareness, what it actually means. And it divides full awareness into four aspects. One of those aspects is the purpose, right? This is really, you're getting really kind of strict about your practice here. But the purpose then means, what is the purpose for what you're doing something? Is it a purpose that aligns with the path that you're practicing here? Right? And if it is a suitable purpose, and it kind of fulfills, helps you fulfill the practice, then it is something you should be doing. Yeah. So it might be when you go into the village, you go for alms. You don't go to see all kind of stuff, right? When you etc. Do things for the right reason. And then there is the suitability. Suitability, very closely related to purpose, is what you're doing. Yes, that is the purpose, but is it also suitable? You can see very closely related to it, or almost hard to distinguish purpose and suitability. They're just two slightly different angles on the same thing. So you might go into the village for alms, but perhaps that is perhaps the wrong time to go. It's not really suitable at that time, or something like that. So you check suitability and purpose together. There's two more aspects as well mentioned in the commentaries, and these are even more kind of profound in a way. One of them is called non-delusion, and the other one is called is Gauchara. Gauchara means it basically means where the cows go, is basically what it means. In other words, what is your, often translated as resort, who do you associate with in the broader sense of the term, like what kind of meditation object do you associate with, and that sort of thing. Yeah. But both of these are very profound, and they are, in my opinion, I'm not even sure if they are actually meant, if that's actually what the suttas imply. So the two important ones are this idea of purpose and suitability. So ask yourself simple questions, right? Is what you're doing, is it going to be purposeful for the path? Is it going to go against the path? And then try to kind of, you know, narrow things down so it becomes more suitable for what you're doing. And as you do that, you find it actually becomes easier to live a pure and wholesome life. It becomes easier to do all the right things. This is kind of the idea behind this. So then we have, further down, you have all of these other things here. I think it's, you know, you have clear awareness about most of these things. Like, for example, You have here drinking, eating and consuming food. You do that with full awareness. The idea here is that you eat what is suitable, right? The right amount, the right quantity, at the right time, and this kind of thing. That's really what it means. You don't overeat, you don't kind of overindulge in this sort of thing here. And then the last one here is quite interesting. It's because it is, I think the translation here is not really perfect. It could be improved upon, because the last one says you have full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up. It doesn't mean falling asleep, it actually means asleep or sleeping, and waking up means wide awake. So the correct translation here, if you know a bit of Pali and Pali grammar, as far as I'm concerned, means that you are acting in full awareness in regard to sleeping and in regard to being awake, in regard to talking and in regard to keeping silent. This is the advantage of knowing a bit of Pali grammar, because you know what translations are possible. You know kind of the range of possible translations, then you have to choose the one that is most appropriate. But you see, then it actually makes good sense, right? Because if you know the right amount in regard to being asleep or in regard to sleeping, it means you know the right, you're supposed to sleep enough, right? So you neither feel tired, nor do you sleep too much, so you feel tired. You find that middle way in regard to sleep as well. You have clear awareness, so you have full awareness about that. You know what is appropriate. Same thing with talking and keeping silent. You know when to talk, when it is appropriate, and when it is not. Now then, if you look at it that way, it all kind of falls into place very nicely, and the meaning becomes much more obvious as to what is going on here. So that is the passage for you on Sampajanya in the gradual training. Presumably that should be fairly clear what is going on there. So now I'm going to move on to a different sutta. This is the Sabhasava Sutta, All the Taints. And it should be found, it is found after the Ratapala Sutta that we did this morning. So I have translated this sutta as All the Corruptions. It's called, in Pali, it's called the Sabhasava Sutta. This is one of those words that is often discussed, how you translate the word asava. And the word asava literally means something like flowing in or flowing out. Right, so you can imagine the mind flowing out into the world, perhaps, because of the defilements in the mind. So it flows out into the world and attaches to things and becomes upset and desiring all this kind of stuff. So that is kind of the root meaning of this word asava. But also the word asava, it is often used as to talk about the three asavas that are the root kind of defilements. Sometimes they call that the kama asava, the asava of a defilement of sensual desire, the bhava asava, the defilement of existence, and the avijja asava, which is the defilement of ignorance or delusion. Delusion is a much better translation for that. So they are basically what they mean. They mean like defilements or corruptions of the mind. That's what I've translated it as here. The Bhikkhu Bodhi uses taints. Taints is like a very kind of weak translation. A taint is like what you put a bit of color in the paint, right, to get a taint or something like that. It's quite a weak translation. It really refers to kind of defilements and corruptions of the mind. These asavas. So one of those quite important words in the Pali language. So let's see what this sutta has to say. This is just a short extract of quite a long sutta. It's quite a nice sutta again. This is just specifically the part that has to do with full awareness really. Except this very first part, which is also quite nice. This is how it starts off. Bhikkhus, I say that the destruction or the ending of the corruptions is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. He knows and sees what? Wise attention and unwise attention. When one attends unwisely, unarisen corruptions arise and arisen corruptions increase. When one attends wisely, unarisen corruptions do not arise, and arisen corruptions are abandoned. Right? So the ending of the asavas is equivalent to arahantship. That's equivalent to full awakening. Yeah? And this is for one who knows and sees, right? You have to actually, and this is kind of a thing that you see throughout the suttas, this idea of yata bhuta jnana dasana. Yata bhuta quite literally means to know and see in accordance with reality. That is what it refers to. So you always have to see things before you can make an end of samsara. And this is why we had this question yesterday about whether, you know, you maybe there is another way than the Eightfold Path, you know, it sounds a bit, is there an easier way, please, that we can have to practice this? And the point here is that you have to know and see in accordance with reality to be able to make an end of this samsaric existence. And the only way that you can know and see, this is something you see throughout the suttas, is through samadhi. You have to have samadhi first, then you can know and see. And of course samadhi only happens through this process of purification. That's how samadhi eventually happens. It's great, right? You have to have samadhi to know and see, but samadhi is such a wonderful thing in its own right. So it's kind of, you have to get more happiness, you have to have happiness to get more happiness. That's what the path is saying. It's good news, isn't it? It's really kind of, it's really nice Buddhist path. Happiness leads to happiness. The Buddha said somewhere in the sutta that before his awakening, he thought that suffering would lead to happiness. And that's why he was practicing a bit like the Jains, right? Because the idea in the Jaina tradition is that you torture yourself, and from that, eventually, you get release, you get happiness. But the Buddha says, no, you don't actually get happiness from suffering. The Buddhist path is more like you get happiness from happiness. You have a certain amount of happiness, and built on that, you get more happiness, and eventually you get the highest happiness. It's a very beautiful path, and this is one of the reasons it's called, you know, like we said on the first day, beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end. Happiness upon happiness upon happiness. So what is it that you know and see? And this knowledge and vision can be understood in many ways. Of course, in the end, knowledge and vision is all about seeing non-self and impermanence and these kind of things. But this here is another way of understanding knowledge and vision. And that is, what you understand is wise attention and unwise attention. Yoniso Manasikara and Ayoniso Manasikara are the Pali terms, very important Pali terms that you see throughout the suttas. So this is one of the things you see. So why is it that you see these things? It sounds a bit strange. How come you see this? And of course the answer is that part of what you understand when you have a real insight is the Four Noble Truths, right? And an important aspect of the Four Noble Truths is actually seeing the Noble Eightfold Path. So you know what the path to awakening is. And in other words, you know every time your mind is heading in the wrong direction, you know that, because you know whether that mind state is on the path or not. Every time the mind is heading in the right direction, you're reflecting wisely, you know that too, because again, you can match it up with the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is what is meant here by the fact that you know wise attention and unwise attention. You know whether your mind is heading in the right direction or not at every moment of time. Right? Most of us, we don't know that. Sometimes we are confused. Am I doing the right thing now? Am I doing the wrong thing? How am I supposed to meditate? Is this state a good one or a bad one? I'm feeling a bit of happiness. Is it the right kind of happiness? Etc., etc. We don't really know for sure. Sometimes we know that we're really off track, right? Because we get really angry or whatever. But a lot of the time, we're sort of heading in the right direction, but not entirely sure where we go from here. We have uncertainty about these things. But the stream actor, the one who knows and sees, knows always whether that mind state is heading in the right direction or not. This is what is meant here by understanding wise attention and unwise attention. So most people, they are just approximating to the Noble Eightfold Path. We're trying our best. We don't know exactly what it is, but we're trying our best to get there. It's only this, that's why it said it's only the stream winner who is actually practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. If because only then do you understand these kind of issues, do you understand what it is all about. Quite interesting in some ways, at least I think so. Then of course, the other thing which is interesting here is that what does it actually mean to attend unwisely? What is this thing called ayoniso manasikara? Now, you don't really, you know, I think many of us, we think that we know, right? Now I'm thinking wise, now I'm thinking unwisely. But it's actually quite hard to pin it down. It's easy to think, now I'm thinking about impermanence, like, I guess that's wise, now I'm kind of being a bit deluded, so that's not so wise. And many people, I think, they believe that they have an understanding what these things are, but actually, the reality is very often we don't really. And even sometimes you may think that you're thinking in terms of non-self, but actually, you haven't really grasped the concept properly. You think you know what suffering is, but you don't really. So it's good to have a very clear idea, a definition, if you want, from the suttas as to what these terms mean. So this idea of yoniso manasikara, of wise reflection, it is something that you take with you from the very beginning of the path, all the way to the very end. So it's one of these things that is very important. If you haven't got a little bit of wise attention at the very beginning, you won't even get started, right? You have to sort of recognize that the Buddha said something useful. If you think that the Buddha didn't know what he was talking about, then you're not going to get anywhere, right? So you have to have a little bit of wise attention at the very beginning. And every step on the path, every time you move forward, there has to be some degree of wise attention which directs you in the right way. And then, towards the very end of the path, when you, let's say, just as you are about to become a stream winner, for example, a stream actor, that too is a moment of wise attention. You attend wisely, that's why you can make the breakthrough. And after you become a stream actor, well then it's quite clear from here, then wise attention is pretty much automatic. You know what is wise attention, you know what is unwise attention. It kind of goes, at that point, it becomes an automatic. And so it's a very important concept. It is one of these things, it says somewhere in the, I think in the Anguttara ones, it talks about all the very basic things that make you progress on the path, right? What is the starting point of this whole Buddhist path? And that can be said to be Kalyanamitta. I talked about that a few days ago. You have to have some kind of Kalyanamitta to even get started. Right, that's one of those. Another one I think is energy. You have to have some energy to kind of get going. But one of these is also yoniso manasikara. Without a little bit of that, you don't even get started on this path. And then it follows you all the way along, all the way to the very end of the path. So how do we know that we have yoniso manasikara? How can we know this? And this here becomes very clear, because this is one of the few places in the suttas where it actually is defined very clearly. That's why this passage is quite interesting. And what it says is that if the unarisen corruptions arise or they increase, that's when it's unwise attention. If the corruptions that are there decrease, right, or disappear, that is when it is wise attention. So basically what this means is that if you are thinking in such a way, if you are perceiving in such a way that defilements arise in your mind, right? You're thinking about someone, you start to get upset. That is ayoniso manasikara right there. If you start to think, whoa, you start fantasizing about the next car you're going to buy while you're meditating, right? Ayoniso manasikara is not wise attention. It may seem very wise at the time, but actually it's not very wise. So this is how it works, right? So it's very simple. You can actually know from where your mind is heading. If your mind is heading towards more defilement, that is where it's ayoniso manasikara. But if you are thinking in such a way that your defilements are reducing, you're becoming more soft-hearted, you're becoming less restless, you're becoming more even-minded, all of these beautiful qualities are arising inside of you. Especially if one particular thought gives rise to that, you know that way of thinking is yoniso manasikara. You are attending in a wise way. That is all that's doing, right? And then you can apply that throughout your life to know whether you're thinking rightly or not. And you can reflect back and you can ask yourself, now that thought, was that yoni somanasikara or ayoni somanasikara? And by looking back, and this is what I'm asking you to do after each meditation, right? Ask yourself, what is working? And then when you reflect and you review that meditation, you can see roughly what you were doing. I was thinking in such a way, that led to peace, right? I was thinking in that way, that led to more restlessness. I was perceiving in such a way, perceiving in that way. And you can see that that thinking, those perceptions, either they lead to something good or something bad. And you can see yoni somanasikara, ayoni somanasikara in practice, how it actually turns out. And as you do that, you learn how to steer the mind in the right direction. This is what this is all about. So very useful, this idea here of how these very central terms in Buddhism, how they are defined and how they can be used to help you, encourage you in your practice. Okay, so I have skipped a big part of this sutta. It is not because it is not interesting, it's just that it's a little bit off topic, so that's why I have cut it out, and I'm going to have a look at these other parts instead. So these parts here that we're going to look at now, they are all about full awareness or clear comprehension that we were just talking about. How do I know that this is what it's about? Because it fits in roughly in that sequence, right? If you look at the rest of the sutta, the previous passage which I haven't included here is all about sense restraint, and then this comes, which is exactly in the same position as it is in the gradual training. And that's how you can deduce that this is all about full awareness. Anyway, so let's get into it. So this is how it goes. So what corruptions monks should be abandoned by using? So using is one of the ways in for abandoning the defilements or the corruptions of the mind. Here a monk, a nun, a bhikkhuni, a layperson, whoever, reflecting wisely, uses the robe only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of concealing the private parts. Right? So this is the first one, how to use your robes as a monastic. It has a particular purpose, and you use it for that purpose. You don't think too much about what kind of robe you have. You are satisfied with whatever kind of robe. You don't get into a kind of... sometimes you can see monastics, they get into trends, right? You have the latest trend in robes. the right color, the right kind of sewing, this kind of stuff. But that is when you are losing the purpose of these things, right? You become more like lay people. Yeah, I got to be the right brand and that sort of stuff. Otherwise, there's no Gucci. Gucci <on the road. laughs> Oops. So the idea of the robes is then to do these things. It's not to arise desire, right? If it arises too much desire as to what robe you have, then it is a problem. So, and also it should be enough to make you feel warm, to make you feel protected from the things outside. So again, it gives this balance, right? It is there to protect you on the one hand so you don't suffer, but it's not there to give rise to desires and unwholesome states. That balance there. And also, of course, this can also apply to lay people as well, right? How do you use your clothes? A lot of time we use clothes to kind of show off our status or whatever and all of these kind of things. But if you don't really want that, if you want to just reduce your ego, not to kind of stand out and all of these kind of things, well, you just use clothes to, it's sufficient to, you know, to feel good, to feel at ease, to feel relaxed. but without kind of making too much of a show out of these things. So one of the nice things about coming on the retreat, whether it's here or Dharma Grove or whatever, very often you just wear very simple clothes. So clothes that are, you know, comfortable to meditate in and that sort of stuff, but nothing more than that. And it kind of makes a bit of the ego fall away, right? A bit of a sense of self. You kind of just flow through the retreat center without thinking about what you look like or anything like that. And it's actually very nice to get rid of that, because too often we are too concerned about such issues, and it is really a burden after a while there. Okay. Then we have a similar, actually I didn't talk about reflecting wisely again. Again we see this idea, this is yoniso patisankha. Patisankha is the same thing I was talking about on the second day or whatever, when I was talking about the two kind of powers, right? The same kind of word here. The other one is patisankha now. This is patisankha, but basically means exactly the same thing here. So you are reflecting yoniso wisely, going back to the root of things, seeing things in the right way. So again, this idea of wise reflection, right? You see this coming again and again, coming throughout. So you think first, then you act afterwards. Reflecting wisely, he uses alms food, neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort, and for assisting the holy life. Considering, thus I shall terminate all feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless, and shall live in comfort. Right? So, this is another nice little passage. This, first of all, this idea of for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness is a little bit strange here, because we might use clothes for that purpose, but exactly how we use food for that purpose is not entirely obvious. And I think the Chinese version of this sutta does not have that there. So it actually quite possibly belongs to the previous one instead of that one. These are the little things that you start to notice when you do comparative studies of these things. Right, but again, the idea here is that you eat in such a way that it supports you, right? You have to eat, you have to live somehow, but you do it in the right way. You find the right balance as far as food and drink is concerned. And it's always nice when you see the sutta. It talks about living in comfort, right? Ending discomfort. Everything is about that. And finding that balance, not indulging on the one hand, but on the other hand, also finding comfort in life. Because you realize you're only going to be able to endure the monastic life especially, but also lay life as a Buddhist, if you feel comfortable, if you feel at ease. If you torture yourself too many kind of harsh practices, chances are you will not last that long here. It's one of those interesting little things that Adam Brahma has often pointed out, is that look at many of those monastics. This is where many of the Westerners in particular, they were really trying to be really tough, right? Trying to really kind of practice the harshest practices possible in the book. And very often, it is unendurable, you just can't do it. And after a while, you end up disrobing as a consequence. So because you haven't found the middle way, right? You are going to one extreme a little bit. It's this habit that we have as human beings of going to extremes all the time. The middle way is actually quite hard to find. You tend to either indulge or to kind of do the exact opposite. But it's when you find the middle way, that is when the monastic life kind of becomes possible. And also lay life as well, to some extent. So using food in the right way, again, a very important aspect here. Reflecting wisely about this. Resting place, again the same kind of thing, right? It is meant for protection from the cold, protection from the heat, gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of warding off the perils of climate and for enjoying retreat. Right? So, this is, first of all, we have, you know, some of these things are very obvious, right? The protection from heat and cold, etc. is great. Gadflies, I don't really know what that is, a strange word. I'm not sure where they got that from. But it's basically some kind of dodgy, unpleasant insect. That's basically what it means. So you get rid of those then. And the creeping things here, the creeping things are kind of any creepy crawlies, right? Like snakes and centipedes and that kind of stuff, which can be a hassle when you have to deal with them. So again, the dwelling is for this purpose, get rid of all of these things. And the beautiful idea of enjoying retreat, right? And this is, of course, that's why you see that in forest monasteries, then monks will live off maybe in kutis. A kuti just means a hut, basically. So you live in a hut where you can be by yourself. It's one of those great things in Bodhidharma monastery. We have really nice huts. Not nice in the sense of, you know, being big or anything like that. They're actually very small. They're only about 7 square meters. But they're plenty large enough for the essentials like sleeping and meditating and for reading the sutta and that kind of stuff. But the nice thing about them is that they are quite secluded, right? When you are in one hut but in another monastery, you cannot really see any other huts. You're completely secluded from everybody else. And that's really nice. You feel like you're far away from the world, right? And after a while, that means that you feel not only does that affect you physically, it affects you mentally as well. You get this feeling of seclusion. You're away from the world, away from the sensuality, away from the crowd, away from all of these things. And all you have around you are trees, right, and birds, and the odd kangaroo, right, and some insects, of course, which always can be very annoying, the odd snake here and there. But apart from that, it's very nice. Nature is very peaceful. One of those interesting things that you find sometimes in the suttas, you find this in like the Theragata, which is also the Therigata. And these are the senior monastics who talk about their life, they talk about it in verse. And very often, well, not very often, but certainly occasionally, and this is especially true for Mahakasapa, he has all these verses about how he enjoys nature, right? All these beautiful verses about the craggy mountain and the trees and the birds that are flying overhead and all these kind of things. So he's obviously enjoying, he's an arahant, right? And he's enjoying kind of nature in that sense. It's quite nice because nature doesn't really give rise to attachment and desires in that way. In fact, it tends to make you peaceful instead. The exact opposite of what the city does, right? The city doesn't make you very peaceful, but nature like that does. So it's one of those things that people often underestimate the importance of having a kuti for yourself far away. In fact, it is so important. This is one of the things that shows you the importance of reading the suttas. And if more people had read the suttas, especially the monastics, they would see these things and they might actually change their behavior and change their intentions as far as monastic life is concerned. And this is you find in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. I think I may have mentioned this before here, but it doesn't matter. And this, in there, it gives you, the Buddha is talking about, this is the last sutta, right? The end of the Buddha's life before he's going about to pass away. And it talks about all of those things that would make Buddhism endure into the future. And at the beginning of the sutta, it talks about the 7 things that lead to non-decline, that lead to increase and lead to the sustaining of the Dhamma into the future, right? 7 things. And some of those are very obvious, like, you know, you meet in harmony or you meet everybody together and that kind of stuff. It's sort of understandable. But one of those things that lead to the long establishment of the Dhamma in the future is that monastics live in the forest, right? It actually says in there, in particular, it said that they should enjoy living in the forest. So this is not something that is kind of just an ideal. It has to do with the very survival of Buddhism into the future. That's how important it is, right? So how come not more monastics, how come 95% of monastics live in villages and in towns and do all kind of other stuff? Well, I think one reason for that is because they haven't read the sutta, right? They forgot the most important part, and because they forgot the most important part, they forgot how to live the life properly. This is part of how these things work. So there are many other reasons, of course, as well, and I'm not going to go into that now, but it shows you again the importance of going back to the early text and asking ourselves, what does the Buddha actually say? And then that kind of changes your aspiration, changes your entire outlook sometimes of these things. There's another sutta as well found in the Anguttara Nikaya somewhere, where the Buddha talks about he's walking around and he's seeing these monks, right? And he sees one monk, and this monk is sitting kind of straight, right, in samadhi, looking very impressive as if he's meditating really well. But he is sitting, he probably is actually meditating very well, but he's sitting on the close to the village, right? Just on the edge of the village. And then he goes into the forest and he sees this other monk. And this monk is really sleepy, right? Nodding away. But he's sitting in the forest. So he's nodding away in the forest. Oh, really tired. But then comes the interesting part about this, because then the Buddha talks about these monks and he praises one of them. And he does not praise the other one. So which one does he praise? Well, most people, well, the one who's sitting in samadhi, right? Because it doesn't matter, as long as you have samadhi, it doesn't matter where you do it. It's what you do that matters. Wrong. It's not like that. This is very powerful and very interesting. What he's saying is that it's actually the monk in the forest who is doing the right thing. Why? Because if he keeps on staying in the forest, meditating in the right place, he will overcome those defilements. He will overcome that tiredness of the mind. And when he does that, he will be practicing the right way, and he will actually achieve some results. But the monk who is meditating close to the village, he will get disturbed, right? He will get disturbed by all the people around, all those kind of things, and then he will fall away from that meditation that he now has. So you can see from the Buddha's point of view, it's not just about what you're doing now, it's about the entire circumstances around it, whether it's going to work in the long run or not. So this is kind of the importance of these kind of things. So that is why the idea of enjoying solitude, enjoying retreat, is an important part for this idea of having a dwelling, a suitable dwelling, a suitable resting place, is part of that. Yes, sir. Yeah.
And one of the unpleasant things is having to go to the toilet in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
What kind of attitudes can you develop to be more at peace
with this creepy crawl, is it? I think after a while we get used to these things, right? If you're not used to it, if you're used to living in Singapore and you're used to kind of living in a place where there aren't that many creepy crawlies, you don't really know how to handle these things. But if you live in nature all the time, after a while you know how to deal with these things. I think it's just become second nature after a while. I mean, you know, Ajahn Brahm tells all the stories of living in Wat Pham Phong in Thailand. And he didn't even have a flashlight sometimes. He had to walk by the starlight in the jungle in the middle of the night, and there were snakes everywhere. But somehow you know how to do that in such a way that you avoid all the bad things. So I think it just has to do with after a while you just get used to the whole thing. But of course occasionally you made mistakes, right? Occasionally there are stories of people getting bitten by these Thai centipedes they have in Thailand. I don't even know what they look like, but I think they're pretty naughty creatures. And apparently very painful, right, when you get bitten by these centipedes. You don't die from it, but really, really bad. So it happens sometimes, but it's actually rare. And it's, you know, you would think that people might die very often. They don't. Monks don't die even though they live in the jungle. Usually they're fine. So somehow, I think you just get used to these kind of things. One of the things that I have noticed as well, even in serpentine, I see snakes quite regularly. Some of them are incredibly poisonous. If you don't get treatment, you will die within an hour, half an hour, or something like that. But they, you know, I used to be a little bit kind of worried about snakes, but once you live around them for a while, you realize they are much, much more afraid of you than you are of them. So unless you step, if you step on it, you might get a bit upset, right? kind of fair enough. But if you don't step on it, even if you are that close, they will usually just run away and be afraid of you. So generally speaking, these animals are much less scary than I think we make them out. The cockroach has come and crawled and was sleeping. Yeah, that's okay. My cockroaches are not friendly. They're not dangerous. Anyway, that's my view of cockroaches, so he's gone. Okay, so what about spiders? Are you okay with spiders, Andrew? Yeah. Spiders coming down the ceiling in the middle of the night, bang, landing on your face. That happens sometimes. Anyway, okay. I shouldn't scare you too much. You'll never come to the monastery again if I tell you these kind of stories. Okay, so then we have the last one, which is about medicinal requisites. Things like cheese and chocolate, right? The medicinal requisite, so it comes under that. It's funny how these things kind of change, you know. Anyway, so reflecting wisely, you use cheese and chocolate only for the protection of bereavement, suffering feelings, and for the benefit of good health. So the idea here is that there are medicines, and some of those medicines are not really medicines, they are more like tonics. Not exactly cheese and chocolate, but some of those things were kind of ballpark. There were things like honey and oil and that sort of thing. And that's why chocolate has become allowable, because it consists only of those things that actually are allowable. Cheese is a bit more debatable, but generally in Thailand it has been considered acceptable. So, same idea again. You use it in the right way, and then when you use it in the right way, it means you can be relaxed and you can enjoy a sense of comfort. So, while taints and vexation and fever, this just means defilements and desires, right, or annoyance, might arise in one who does not use the requisites thus, there are no corruptions and anger and desires in one who uses them in this way. These are called the corruptions that should be abandoned by using them. Okay, next one is the corruptions to be abandoned by enduring them. What taints bhikkhus should be abandoned by enduring them? Here, a bhikkhu reflecting wisely bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contact with unpleasant flies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creepy crawlies. He endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words, and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, charm, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing to life. And again, while pains, vexations, or corruptions, upset, and desires might arise in one who does not endure such things, there are no corruptions, upset, and desires in one who endures them. These are called the corruptions that should be abandoned by enduring. So here, the idea is that there are certain things in life you just cannot get away from. You can see so far the emphasis has been on being comfortable. But it's not possible to always be comfortable. Sometimes you can use a mosquito net, you can use a hut, but still the mosquito somehow manages to get inside, right? And you kind of hear the buzzing of the mosquito, and you know how hard it can be to fall asleep when you hear the buzzing mosquito around you. So sometimes you just have to endure these things. Sometimes the climate is just unpleasant, and there is no air conditioning perhaps where you are, or perhaps you don't have a heater at the right time. Or you go on arms round and perhaps there isn't sufficient food and all these kind of things. Sometimes you just have to learn to endure. Life is always like that. You can never have perfect comfort. And if you seek for perfect comfort, then you are on an endless quest for the impossible. So sometimes you just have to know when to say enough is enough, when you should endure, and when you should actually search, look for it to make it more comfortable. Find that right balance in the world. And of course, one of those things that are definitely impossible to avoid altogether, that is of course the ill-spoken, unwelcome words, right? How often don't we have to bear up with unwelcome words? It is just so common in life. Every day, presumably, we hear some words that aren't all that welcome. Except when you come here on retreat, of course, then you hear mostly welcome words. And if you don't, maybe when you hear the word of the Buddha, you think, whoa, this is too much. Don't want to hear that. Don't want to know about those things, right? It's a bit like that sometimes. But At least, because you know it's from the Buddha, you're probably more willing to listen than you are if somebody else comes along and says something which is unwelcome. But the world is full of unwelcome words. People always say silly things, right, without thinking. And we always have to learn to endure those things. You cannot avoid people saying bad things. It's just absolutely impossible. So after a while, you, instead of focusing on the person, you realize this is the nature of the world. The nature of people is like this. You're not going to be able to avoid it. Okay, I'm just going to endure it. Whatever it is, say, it's their problem, not mine. Forget about it. So this is how you... Of course, we can avoid unwelcome words a little bit, right? By going to the right place and that sort of thing. But there is a limit to how much you can do that. So this is about wisdom again. You know how to balance these things out. And of course, the same thing is true about the bodily feelings. Sometimes you just have to endure, right? The body sometimes just doesn't want to do what you want it to do. And then you have to endure these things. In meditation practice, I would advise you not to endure all that much. Endure a tiny bit, because a tiny bit of unpleasantness is a part of the body. You can't avoid that. But don't endure more than you have to. And a good rule of thumb is, you know, when the pain or the unpleasantness becomes such that you can't get your mind off it anymore, your mind kind of gets stuck into it, you're always going back to the displeasure, then it's good to change your posture, to do something else. So be careful not to become averse to meditation by enduring too much. Have a good time, enjoy yourself, and be comfortable. It is so important. There's enough pains to be endured down the road anyway, as you get older, etc., etc. Okay, so that is enduring, right? Remember, it is about wisdom. Know the time to endure, know the time not to endure. And then we have avoiding. So what corruptions, figures, should be abandoned by avoiding? Here a monk, reflecting wisely, avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull, a wild dog, a snake, a stump, a bramble, a patch, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspit, a sewer. Reflecting wisely, he avoids sitting on unsuitable seats, wandering to unsuitable places, and associating with bad friends. Since if he were to do so, wise companions in the holy life might suspect him of bad conduct. While corruptions, upsets, and desires might arise in one who does not avoid these things, there are no corruptions, upsets, and desires in one who avoids them. These are called corruptions that should be abandoned by avoiding him. So, again, you know, you avoid this kind of thing. It's a bit strange, right? Avoiding a wild elephant and a wild dog and a bramble patch and a cliff. It kind of seems obvious that you should avoid this thing, or a cesspit, you know. But maybe the point, perhaps, is that sometimes you can think that you're a really tough kind of person, right? And you kind of put yourself in harm's way to check out how tough you are. But the Buddha is saying, there's no point in doing that. Find the middle way. Get back to what is sensible. Don't try to be some kind of superman or superwoman, but find that middle way instead. But then comes perhaps the more important part again, and that is to avoid the unsuitable seats, right? Unsuitable places. And again, this is all about those places where you might get into trouble. Right, so for example, as a monk and as a nun, you have rules about not sitting alone with the opposite gender, right? Because things can at least, not always, but sometimes they can get out of hand. You don't know what's going to happen. So this is kind of being wise about that, understanding the potential for the defilements to arise if you put yourself in an unsuitable situation. That is what is meant by unsuitable seats. It doesn't mean a seat with nails or anything like that. It means a seat which is who you are resorting to. And of course, also associating with bad friends. I was talking the first day about the importance of having good friendship. And again, remember that how easily influenced we are by our surroundings, how conditioned we are. And when you understand how conditioned you are, you actually know the importance of hanging around with the right people. So you avoid the bad people. This is what this is about. So all very common sense, but very often we forget about common sense. And because of that, we kind of heading off in the wrong direction. And then the last phrase here, I think, is a mistake in translation. Since he were to do so, wise companions in the whole life might suspect him of bad conduct. It doesn't sound very noble, right? You don't do it just because others might suspect you. It doesn't sound like a very noble reason for avoiding these things. And the correct translation, I think, is rather that you avoid those because these are things that your wise companions in the holy life think of as unsuitable. Because your wise companions say it is unsuitable, well, you take it on board as faith initially that these are unsuitable things, so you don't do them as a consequence. That is what it means. It's not because they suspect you of evil conduct, but it's because you know that the wise companions say that this is unsuitable. That makes far better sense, right? So, and then, based on all that, then you avoid all of these problems that arise from these things. So that is a bit of details about the idea of full awareness. So again, the idea here, we talked previously about sense restraint, how to avoid the arising of bad thoughts. And this is like an expansion of that. How to protect yourself to the maximum ability so you don't get into situations where you are encourage defilements to arise in the mind. And I think it is not just for monastics, but as I said, it also works for lay people as well. And there are certain things in life that you know will encourage defilements and problems. So you avoid those and you find a place where you have more smooth and easy path, where your mind is more relaxed and at ease. And if you find that your mind is more relaxed and at ease, you find that it doesn't kind of go up and down all the time, you know, between being excited about things and being averse and negative about things. But you find that middle way, it becomes also much easier to practice in daily life. You see the opportunities for doing the good things much more easily. And you're able to react to the situations around you in a much more skillful way when your mind is nice and balanced, rather than just going up and down and all these kind of things. Okay, so that is it for this afternoon. Once again, I'll see you again this evening at 8 o'clock, and let's just pay respect to the Buddha Sangha first.